Hello, and welcome to the Critical Voter Podcast. My name is Jonathan Haber, and all I could say is, were those conventions fun? Actually, I can and will say a lot more than that, especially about this week's topic, which is media and media literacy. But before going there, I hope those of you who have been following the blog have gotten a sense of how the critical thinking skills we've been discussing can be put to practical use. Those blog posts are still up, so you can read them in their entirety. But just to sum up, after looking at how Mitt Romney organized or arranged his acceptance speech during last week's podcast, we took a look at the acceptance speeches of both presidential candidates with regard to their use of logos, pathos, and ethos, Aristotle's three modes of persuasion, and verb tense to see how the candidates balanced laying blame for the past versus celebrating the present versus planning or promising for the future. Then we took a look at each candidate's use of rhetorical devices, capping off an examination of how all the critical thinking components we've been discussing over the last several weeks manifest themselves during the course of a political campaign. Most analyses of this type beg for some kind of handicapping or judgment regarding who gave the best versus the worst speeches. While the point of this nonpartisan podcast is not to evaluate the candidates in terms of pushing your vote one way or another, I think it's fair to critique the speechmakers in terms of their use of the tools of persuasion we've been discussing. As I mentioned on the blog, my biggest surprise came when I discovered how much President Obama didn't conform to what I would have expected with regard to the rules of arrangement. His speech, as I described, consisted primarily of ethos and pathos-based appeals that, while not structured randomly, did not surround a logos-based core, as did Romney's acceptance speech. Romney's reliance on logos is no great surprise, given the candidate's business-like approach to politics. The reason I'm drawing out this aspect of his talk for special praise is that people with his background can easily fall in the trap of giving a speech that sounds like it should be accompanied by a PowerPoint presentation. So what impressed me most about him was his skill in presenting his facts and logical arguments in a way that didn't leave the audience feeling like they were being lectured to by their boss. Where Romney didn't do so well was in the use of pathos or emotional appeal. His attempt to establish ethos during his introduction, by making a joke about his iPod playlist, was also a bit of a bust, although he did do a good job at connecting with the audience later through an appeal to shared American values. But it was his pathos-based appeals that suffered the most from dwelling on the past and focusing on negative emotions when he tried to generate disappointment and occasionally anger in the audience over what he claimed were promises made but not kept during Obama's first term in the White House. Obama, as I just mentioned, put much more emphasis on ethos and pathos, which allowed him to do a better job establishing emotional uplift, especially during the conclusion or peroration of his speech. This should not surprise us, since the president is really a master of the peroration, whose speeches tend to reach a dramatic climax, much like the church sermons that are the model for his speaking style. And in his defense, Obama's limited and vaguer use of logos may be the result of his role as the incumbent. For as an incumbent, he has to balance an acknowledgement that the high expectations he set in 2008 may not have been met, while simultaneously trying to gin up the same level of enthusiasm he created in 08 this time around. Given the balance he needed to strike, he couldn't deny the fact that problems, notably with the economy, still trouble us. But he was also under no obligation to provide a point-by-point, fact-based description and analysis of those problems in gory detail. As for who gave the best speech at either convention, that prize would have to go to former President Bill Clinton. As listeners of the podcast where I discussed modes of persuasion may remember, I chose Clinton as the best example I could think of a contemporary politician who balances logos, pathos, and ethos in just the right combination. And all that skill was on display at the Democrats' confab in Charlotte, including extended but still accessible discussions of complex issues, in this case Obama's economic policies, combined with emotional appeals to caring and fairness, i.e. the good emotions, that he truly seemed to be speaking from the heart. Finally, he wrapped everything in that folksy use of language we remember from his years in office, which helped shield him from seeming angry or hostile, even when he was delivering some of the most caustic zingers of the convention. The general consensus among most media types was that Clint Eastwood, who introduced Mitt Romney, delivered the most embarrassing rhetorical moments of either convention. But here I like to come to Eastwood's defense, and not just because I'm a fan of what he's done both in front of and behind the camera. True, the one talent Eastwood, an accomplished actor, director, and musician, lacks is the ability to deliver convincing dialogue, an especially challenging problem for him since his limitation stands in such stark contrast to his incredibly communicative facial expressions and body language. Anyone who's seen one of my favorite Eastwood pictures, White Hunter Black Heart, will know what I'm talking about with regard to the jarring effect of stiff dialogue delivered through an Academy Award-deserving face. So it may have been a bad choice to recruit him for such an important job requiring this type of political oratory. That said, Eastwood was being judged for his unwillingness, or maybe his inability to follow the conventions of a professional political speech, which today involves reading from a teleprompter without looking like you're reading from a teleprompter. That's what all that turning your head left and right while maintaining eye contact with a camera during most televised speeches is all about, as well as following the rhetorical rules we've been discussing in the context of a presentation that has been highly polished to meet the expectations of a television audience. Generally, when someone strays from these conventions, be he Clint Eastwood or George Bush Jr., we tend to judge them as losing it or stupid. But it may just be that we've been so trained to expect certain things from a political speaker that we become disappointed or even hostile when they don't speak or behave as they're supposed to. This is not to say that we should assume the Eastwoods or Bushes of the world are actually master communicators who are just misunderstood. We should be willing to look below the surface before passing judgment, especially when, love them or hate them, a politician or actor-turned-politician has a track record of success with regard to engaging and convincing audiences. Now, a moment ago, I mentioned a character we've not discussed up until now who spent the last couple of weeks sitting in judgment of not just Eastwood, but of every speaker at both party conventions. And that character is called the media, a third party or fourth estate that we'll be concentrating on during this week's podcast. It's hard to underestimate the importance of a media that sometimes seems to upstage the parties, the candidates, and even the voters during the period of a presidential campaign. Sometimes a candidate will focus more attention on them than they do their direct opponent, such as John McCain, who railed against the liberal media for trashing his vice presidential pick while allegedly giving his opponent a free ride. Before we talk about the liberal media, a pejorative conservatives use when news coverage doesn't go their way, or the corporate media, the sneer used by liberals who feel that motivation for profits caused the media to ignore issues of importance to them, what exactly do we mean when we're talking about the media? Traditionally, by media, we're referring to the news media, or more specifically, the popular news sources of the day. This once consisted primarily of newspapers and magazines, but as technology changed, the media came to include radio, then television, and now the internet, a technology that is in the process of subsuming all these other media types. For most of the issues that come up during a political campaign, most of our background knowledge surrounding those issues is delivered to us via these news sources. And as Kevin DeLaPlante from Critical Thinker Academy points out in much of his work, one cannot minimize the importance of such background knowledge in any critical thinking exercise. Logic, rhetoric, and all the other analytical or persuasive techniques we've been discussing over the last several weeks are vital too, of course. But if you don't understand the substance of a subject you are debating or analyzing, i.e. if you don't know what you're thinking or talking about, then you're not going to get very far, regardless of how skilled an analyst or speaker you may be. Now, traditional analysis of the media might break media down into specific categories, newspapers, television, the internet, and see what behavioral, cultural, or economic factors tend to drive each one. But for purposes of critical thinking, we need to look at something far more fundamental. How information delivered by any of these media get processed by our senses and delivered to our brains to be turned into the background information needed to inform our judgments. When we talk about our senses, and again I'm indebted to Jay Heinrichs for his analysis of the topic in the book Thank You for Arguing, it's useful to think of our five senses in the context of the three modes of persuasion, logos, pathos, and ethos. For example, three of our five senses, touch, smell, and taste, do not really come into play during a political campaign or other type of debate that involves some element of critical thinking, since these senses are entirely conduits for emotion and connection, pathos and ethos, rather than logic, logos. The emotional power of smell, for example, is the reason why real estate agents recommend you bake bread before showing your house, since the resulting baking odor allegedly triggers a positive emotional response of comfort and happiness. And the emotional power of taste is why most first dates and anniversaries take place in fancy restaurants versus hot dog stands. Touch can actually be an ethos driver, especially when we judge our relationship with someone by the strength of their handshake or whether they choose a handshake over a hug. In fact, some cultures have elaborate rules with regard to how touch-based rituals reflect levels of intimacy or hierarchy. Just watch how the French dole out those alternating kisses on the cheek to see what I'm talking about. But in terms of critical thinking, the most important senses are those that define media, hearing and sight. As Heinrich points out, hearing is probably our most logos-based sense, which may be one of the reasons why education still leans so heavily on the spoken lecture, and why online classes that do not include an audio component tend to feel dissatisfying. As an avid podcast listener, and now producer, I can attest to the efficiency of audio in allowing you to pack a lot of information into a short period of time, which I suspect has something to do with our hearing being so adept at processing logos-based content. This is not to say that hearing is all about logos and nothing else. To cite the most obvious example, music is probably the most powerful controller of emotional state I can think of. And the more our speech tends to resemble music with regard to tone, cadence, or rhyming, the more emotional information we are able to pack into our audio-delivered statements, whether by shouting our words to express anger, or raising or lowering our voice in a pattern when we say something like, "You're going out with him?" to express scorn or disbelief. Now, you would think that sight is also primarily logos-based, given the role sight plays in reading, with reading skill, under the name literacy, used to define the intellectual capacity of an individual or society. But in addition to seeing words, we also see images, either still images like a photo, drawing, or chart, or moving images like a video or animation. And while images can be powerful tools for communicating logos-based information, a picture can speak 1,000 words after all, they're just if not more powerful in delivering emotional content. And when words, either written or spoken, and images are put into conflict with one another, the images invariably win out. To illustrate this, let's say that instead of listening to this podcast, you're instead reading these same words off a transcript. Now imagine, rather than giving you printed pages with only words on them, I instead gave you a transcript that had adorable but utterly irrelevant photos of cute puppies printed at the top of each page. Chances are, no matter how compelling you found my words, you would not be able to take your eyes off those puppies. And rather than read through the transcript so you can get back to the photos, you're more likely to flip through the pictures first and then get back to your reading, unless you've already thrown the whole document in the trash and gone off to the pet shop to buy yourself a dog. The power of images to overwhelm words underlines an arms race between media sources and politicians, each of which wants to control the story coming out of a big event like a national election. This arms race became a media story itself in 1984, when CBS journalist Leslie Stahl ran an extended segment on the nightly news that strung together video of President Ronald Reagan's carefully orchestrated campaign events, with a reporter's narration contrasting the candidate's pomp and promises with what she considered to be the darker reality of his administration. Regardless of what you think of Stahl and CBS's choice to run a piece of this type, the punchline of this tale was that rather than condemning the piece, the Reagan campaign instead called the journalist to thank her and her network for giving their colorful and carefully orchestrated campaign events so much free primetime exposure. For these campaign operatives understood what CBS did not, that when presented with powerful, celebratory images in the form of exciting campaign activities, no amount of ominous negative narration can overwhelm those positive visuals. Media literacy, a field that emerged in the 1970s as a way to teach children how to deal with the flood of information they were receiving from modern media sources, especially television, spent a great deal of time looking at how we should approach visual information. As just described, our old friends Logos and Pathos provide one set of analysis tools we can use as we think through the visuals that make up or accompany media-driven material we may be evaluating. For instance, is a photograph or a chart included in a newspaper story designed to add information, which would make it logos-based, or has been included to create a mood or influence your attitude towards the words you're reading, which would make it more about pathos? To take one example, I recently saw a story about a troubling report released on the U.S. economy, above which ran a picture of President Obama mopping his brow, with his face showing an expression of obvious discomfort. This juxtapositioning of the story with this image was clearly meant to give the impression that Obama was worried about the negative economic news. But given that there's no information regarding where and when this photo was taken, Obama might have become sweaty and worried when he received the report and may actually be wiping his brow with a copy of it. Or he might just have gotten off of Air Force One on a hot Washington summer day, in which case his sweat and discomfort had nothing to do with the story in question. So in this case, I would make the assumption that the photo was added to create a mood and is thus pathos-based, meaning I should not take it at face value. More importantly, I should not let myself be forced into concluding that the president is fretting about this news so much that it has caused him to lose his cool. Media literacy also teaches us to think through the origins as well as the relevance of media-driven visuals. We should obviously be on the lookout for outright fraud, such as photos that have been doctored using tools like Photoshop in a way that changes their meaning. And we need also be mindful of images and video that have been posed or choreographed to generate misinformation or emotional impact. This last technique has become so common with regard to media manipulation related to war news that a cottage industry has emerged to debunk imagery of wins, losses, and casualties, especially civilian casualties, generously provided to the media by one or more sides in a conflict. More often than not, however, we are not confronted by fake images so much as images that are too good to be true, like my Obama mopping his brow example. And it's not just the media that creates these images and layouts designed to push you to think one way or another. Politicians and advertisers are both masters of these techniques, which they use to try to control how both we and the news media treats their messages and priorities. One of my favorite examples of this took place during the first term of Ronald Reagan when, in the course of 1 week in 1982, he was dealing with the death of hundreds of Marines from a truck bomb in Lebanon and the decision to invade Grenada, a Caribbean island that had just suffered a Marxist coup. The image showed Reagan in his pajamas and bathrobe taking a call with a look of awareness and concern on his face. And this remarkable image was featured on page one of hundreds of newspapers as well as many magazine covers. Even TV shows, which prefer moving to still images, featured it, given its strength in communicating the message that the president is on the job, day and night, dealing with major international crises. But the first question everyone seeing this image should have asked themselves is, where did it come from? Did an AP photographer just happen to be walking by the room Reagan was staying in late one night when the call came in? Or was this image taken and maybe even posed by the White House itself to give the impression they wanted the media and public to receive? Fundamentally, media literacy asks us to grasp that any information we are presented with, be it words, sound, pictures, or video, is a product of human beings, either as individuals or as part of organizations. And these people and organizations are likely to have their own biases, agendas, and desires, including the desire to influence us one way or another. The Reagan photo example I just gave you, along with negative ads that present tiny snippets of an opponent's speech, or the warm and fuzzy campaign biopics produced for each party's convention, are obvious examples where people with an agenda are trying to use the power of media to get you to think and vote in a particular way. This does not mean that everything that appears in photos, ads, or videos created by the political parties are false and misleading. It simply means that you should understand the agenda the originators of this material have before either taking what they give you at face value or, just as importantly, dismissing everything they say as lies and propaganda. Agenda and bias, which are easy to determine in the case of actual political candidates and parties, are a bit trickier to ascertain with regard to independent news sources such as newspapers, radio, or TV programs. Since most of us like to believe that such news sources, at least the ones we watch, listen, or subscribe to, are staffed by hard-bitten, skilled reporters who are just interested in getting you the facts and following the story no matter where it leads. No doubt, this romantic notion of the journalist as truth-seeker without an agenda is one that members of the media like to believe about themselves. But we should not dismiss this as a work of fiction, just because many news sources hide behind such mythology, especially when they're caught spreading falsehoods or clearly tilting their coverage one way or another. As I mentioned before, many conservatives tend to condemn the media as liberal, citing facts regarding the voting patterns of many big-name journalists, or the pattern of major newspapers to endorse Democratic versus Republican candidates. Meanwhile, liberals are often pointing out the fact that many media sources are owned by large for-profit corporations, implying that this influences what stories they cover and how they cover them. I don't think either criticism can or should be dismissed outright, although it might be useful to look at them from a perspective other than partisanship. I thought this while reading an intriguing short book called Trust Me, I'm Lying, Confessions of a Media Manipulator, a Cri de Coeur written by Ryan Holiday, a marketing and PR man skilled at using the new rules of internet media to spread his own stories, including marketing messages and rumors, as news. In that book, he provides a different perspective, a historical perspective, on the economic argument I just mentioned, pointing out that newspapers, to cite as historic precedent, have always been selling a product. But how that product is defined can help us evaluate its strengths and shortcoming with regard to accuracy and bias. For example, when newspapers are sold one at a time on the street, their owners made more money the more copies they sold, which is why they came out with extra editions, as in, extra, extra, read all about it, and why they stress sensational stories in order to get people to buy their paper versus someone else's. Later, newspapers like the New York Times changed their business model, whereby they made their money by selling subscriptions, which meant that their product was not each individual edition which had to be sold on its own merits, usually based on how interesting or sensational the content, but on the integrity of the institution, which could be trusted to deliver a quality product on a regular basis. Holiday chose this example to provide some perspective on the new media, an internet-driven media that consists not just of online versions of traditional news venues, but a host of news sources such as blogs, social media sites, and Twitter feeds. We'll be talking more about what this new media means and pretends in a minute. But for now, I hope you could see how Holiday's insight into the nature of news as a product, sold one at a time based on immediacy versus sold long-term based on trust, for example, can tell us more about the impact of economics on the news than simply dissing the entire media as a bunch of corporate stooges. If we think about each of the news sources we encounter as some type of product, we're in a position to evaluate them based on something other than our own partisan beliefs. For instance, some news sources still sell themselves to potential subscribers, viewers, or listeners based on quality and an alleged lack of bias, while others sell themselves based on assurance of a certain type of bias. We've already talked about the trend of people developing their own news feeds, consisting of cable and radio talk shows, newspapers, and websites designed to conform with their own beliefs and biases. And given that our fractured media age allows us to create such news feeds with ease, the onus is on us as critical thinkers to ask the right questions so that we can properly evaluate the sources of our information, rather than caving into our confirmation biases or, just as bad, becoming so cynical that we refuse to believe anything we don't discover directly with our own senses, which in the modern world effectively condemns us to ignorance. Now, I've been dancing around the subject of the internet over the course of this podcast, but I'd like to spend the rest of the time talking about it, since this new media technology is in the process of not just transforming the producers of media who use it, but the consumers of media as well, including all of us. When the net started becoming part of our lives, it was easy to look at it as just one more technology, like radio and television, that might compete with traditional information sources, like books, newspapers, and magazines, but would eventually take its place alongside them. But as the internet becomes the primary delivery system for all the visual and audio information we've described as the fundamental building blocks of media, words, images, video, this has led to fundamental changes in the nature of traditional news sources. Most importantly, this new technology has broken the monopoly those news sources had for decades, even centuries, over who gets to report the news. Back in ancient times, i.e. the 1970s and 80s, when the field of media literacy emerged, the underlying assumption behind that field was that people had to develop filters or analytical skills to avoid being manipulated by media that was created and distributed primarily by large institutions, such as corporations and governments. After all, as the old saying goes, freedom of the press belongs to those who own one, or can afford one. But with each technological breakthrough in self-publishing, starting with desktop publishing in the 1980s, moving online through blogging, and continuing today with tools that allow anyone with modest technical competence to become a book or magazine publisher, podcaster, or YouTube video producer, presses that can get your information to anyone in the world are not just commonplace, but are practically free. Today, in theory anyway, anyone with a free Blogger account can break a news story just as easily as the New York Times. And anyone willing to struggle with recording hardware and software and a few internet tools can become a podcaster or YouTube programmer, competing for listeners and viewers with the major television and radio stations. But while the tools empowering this democratization of the media may be free, the internet phenomena, like most world-changing technical revolutions, comes at a cost. First off, the internet is not just sitting alongside newspapers, magazines, radio, and television competing for your attention. Rather, it is in the process of absorbing all those other forms of media, creating cultural change with economic consequence, especially happen to be running a newspaper or magazine that used to have twice as many subscribers and contain twice as many ads as it does today. Traditional news sources that weather the storm will do so by reinventing themselves, and they may even be able to dominate certain areas of the net like they used to dominate the newsstands and broadcast spectrum. But even if they manage to pull this off, or just survive, they have now to compete with anyone with a web browser ready to call him or herself a journalist. Now, this is not necessarily a bad thing. I remember reading once how journalism is similar to academics and that there are far more qualified people trained and skilled at doing these jobs than there are paid media positions in the case of journalists or tenured teaching positions in the case of college professors. Which may explain why there's so much high-quality news and educational content on the web, since the internet provides an outlet for people with these talents that doesn't require job interviews, long apprenticeships, or tenure fights as the price of entry. At the same time, this technology allows any nut with a grudge to publish any crap they like, worldwide, without any need that it be accurate, intelligent, or even coherent. Back in the day, if a newspaper wanted to publish a story, particularly of a newsworthy event such as a scoop or scandal, they required journalists to double-check their facts and provide multiple sources for their information and quotes. And if the paper or network got the story wrong, which they frequently did regardless of the checks they allegedly had in place, the public had someone to point a finger at, and an institution would have to pay a price, at least in terms of tarnished reputation. But as newspapers, radio, and TV news became more and more part of the internet, they began to pick up the flaws of internet journalism, especially with regard to speed, sensationalism, and lack of accountability. With a news cycle now measured in minutes, and rewards in the form of search engine rankings going to those who publish firsts, it's in everybody's interest to get the story out immediately, regardless of whether it's a confirmed double-check story or a rumor sent via anonymous email. Just as insidious, we've created a system referred to as the link economy, a term first popularized by the writer Jeff Jarvis, which Ryan Holiday accurately condemns as the means whereby journalists can pass the buck with regard to taking responsibility for their own carelessness and sloppy reporting. This link economy works by giving the impression that as long as you link to a source, you performed your obligations as a researcher. If what you publish ends up being a bunch of hooey, well, blame it on the person you linked to, since it was they, not you, that didn't do their job. Not only does this rush to publish and the willingness to link rather than confirm make web journalism sloppier than traditional journalism ever was, even on its worst day, It also opens up the whole system to manipulation by people like Holiday, who know which blogs will publish unsubstantiated rumors or even lies, which major websites will republish the story because it appeared in someone else's blog, and which news services will push the story into the mainstream by presenting it as a story making its way around the internet, rather than put the effort in discovering the news themselves. Now, there are many, many occasions when this free-for-all has had positive consequences. Totalitarian societies that can keep ABC News from landing at their airports are struggling to keep dissidents from getting the news out via social media and internet journalists from publishing it worldwide. And even scandal, like President Clinton's affair with Monica Lewinsky, broke on the blogs before the mainstream media would touch a story that turned out to be major news. Given that somewhere on the internet, there probably exists high-quality, well-researched news and well-thought-out commentary that can inform our decisions, but that this material may be hidden in a hay pile of nonsense, slander, and bunk, we're left with several choices. One, we can believe whatever we discover online, especially if the author provides links and lots of footnotes and graphs to give their information and analysis weight, regardless of whether those links and graphs mean anything. Two, we could use these wonderful new tools to create a custom news feed for ourselves that is designed not to filter high quality from low quality information, but to play to our own confirmation biases. Those who have been following this podcast since the beginning will remember what I said about bias back in episode 2, that it is natural for our brains to settle on stories, like that of the fabulous candidate A and its despicable rival candidate B, and then accept unquestionably any information that confirms this belief while rejecting anything that challenges it. Well, now, thanks to the internet, we can automate this whole news filtration process, creating a custom reality for ourselves in which our opinions and preconceptions go perpetually unchallenged. Or we could take on the job of being critical thinkers who understand how to locate the right information, evaluate it for quality, organize it so it makes sense, synthesize it into answers to our questions, and communicate those answers to others responsibly. Those five processes I just outlined, locating, evaluating, organizing, synthesizing, and communicating information, are actually the five components of another literacy, information literacy, that is so important to critical thinking in our internet age that I'll be dedicating the next podcast to the subject. But before signing off, I want to recommend one other book that talks about not what the internet is doing to our media or our politics, but to us. The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains, written by Nicholas Carr, makes the case that the precedent for the internet is not technological breakthroughs like TV and radio, but more fundamental inventions, such as the invention of written language. Before writing existed, people were not dolts or bumpkins. In fact, one of history's greatest thinkers, Socrates, not only didn't write anything down, but questioned the entire value of writing in the first place. For he was living in an oral society, a society where a powerful intellect was fueled by a powerful memory, which is why memory is one of those five canons of rhetoric I discussed in the previous podcast. But once writing freed people from having to memorize everything worth talking or thinking about, it also eliminated the need for whatever abilities such prodigious memory empowered. The world was obviously better off with written language, but we did lose something in the process, the brain's ability to store and quickly retrieve the massive amount of memorized information it once could. Today, our memory is freed even more, since whenever a question comes up that we cannot answer, we can just pull out our smartphone, pop up a browser, and look it up. And there's no question that having 24/7 access to a library as big as the internet is, like writing, a positive thing. But just as with the invention of writing, it also has costs, including the atrophying of our ability to recall what we can now Google. Think about this the next time you use your computer to remind you of what day your anniversary or kid's birthday falls on. Or remind yourself while skimming through the pages of an ebook, pausing every few minutes to check your mail, how you used to give similar books your undivided attention just a few years ago when they were printed and you were reading them in silent solitude. Unfortunately, I have to end this week's podcast on that provocative note, especially since I have to save this electronic audio, manipulate the media file, in this case by editing out the burps and telephone rings you'll never hear, and get it delivered to you via that same internet thingy I've just been warning you about. Just one more set of things to think about as you wait to join us for the next Critical Voter podcast.